Sacramentalism, the ninth talk in a series titled Historical Alternatives to Biblical Christianity, was presented by Jack Crabtree on March 5, 1996, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
The topic is sacramentalism. I will undoubtedly slip and call it sacramentalism every now and then. Sacramentalism. I told Shelby that was the belief that you have to believe that Sacramento is the capital of California in order to be saved. That's sacramentalism. She said it is. So that was Los Angeles. Yeah, she said. Okay, first of all, let me define what it is, and we will define what it is by looking at this chart. And this chart is my attempt to try to exhaustively cover, most of the ways. To try to be exhaustive in covering the different options for how you view sacraments. So I have these different columns: the nature of a sacrament, the nature of one's obligation to perform the sacramental rite, the logic of the sacramental obligation, the nature of the grace imparted by the sacrament, and then the particular sacramental rites themselves. So for those of you who may not know what a sacrament is, let's look at the last column on the right first. You want to pick up this handout, Roger? Protestants typically believe in two sacraments, baptism and the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper. There are a couple of denominations or Christian traditions that don't believe in any sacraments, but most of the Protestant traditions believe that those first two, baptism and the Lord's Supper, are sacraments. The Roman Catholics believe in five more: marriage, confirmation, ordination, penance, and extreme unction. And we can get into those and what those are if you want. But for my purposes, it's not all that important what they are, because I want to just talk about sacraments in general and the very concept of a sacrament rather than the specific things. But that's what we're talking about when we talk about a sacrament. A sacrament is a rite that where the sacred breaks into the ordinary or the mundane in some way. That's the idea. Okay, the question... We're talking about those kinds of religious rites that are considered sacraments by some people, and the question is, what exactly is sacramentalism? What do people who believe in what I'm calling sacramentalism believe? And I'm defining it by the people that believe one or more of those beliefs that have the little double asterisk in the lower right-hand corner. So there's these different questions and each of or topics, and I have under each topic different options for different views that would address that topic or that question. The first one has two: the nature of a sacrament. There's view number one and view number two, Roman numeral one and two. The nature of one's obligation to perform the sacramental rite. There's four views: A, B, C, and D. The logic of the sacramental obligation. There's four different views of what that logic is. 1, 2, 3, 4. The nature of grace imparted by the sacrament, small a, b, and c. And then I listed the sacraments. And what I'm calling sacramentalism is if you had one or more of the views addressing any one of those topics that are indicated by the asterisks, then you are what I'm going to call a sacramentalist.
Just so that I'm clear, these do not necessarily go across the rows.
No.
You're not saying that baptism is necessarily number 1A.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Well, baptism on the end is in the first row across the top, but you're not saying that it necessarily goes with number one over there, the physical ray is a channel of an invisible spiritual
right. Yeah,
rays.
Good question. No, there's no correlation. These are just options, yeah. You with me on how to read the chart?
Okay. So just for clarification again, if you were asking the question, what is the nature of the sacrament? If you answer one, then you would be a sacramentalist. If you would answer two, then you would not be a sacramentalist.
Okay, no. If you answer one, then you are a sacramentalist by my definition. If you answer two, you may or may not be, depending upon how you answer the nature of one's obligation to perform the rite, the logic of sacramental obligation, and so on. That is, I want to ask you every one of these questions before we're done. And if in any one of these columns you give me an asterisk to answer, then you are a sacramentalist.
We got you.
Okay. All right, let's look at what these are. First of all, the first column, nature of a sacrament. One answer to give to that is that it's a physical rite or the physical rite. No, I'm sorry. Is to take the position that the physical rite is a channel of invisible spiritual grace. And if we're going to talk about it being a channel of grace, then we are pretty much thinking of grace substantively as some kind of substance. Energy, invisible stuff, spiritual stuff, I don't care what, but we are thinking of it, we are mentally picturing it as some kind of stuff in order for it to need a channel to go through. And that's certainly one view on the nature of a sacrament. It seems to me the only other possible view, the only other alternative, is that the physical rite is a tangible physical metaphor of some kind, a picture, a symbol. We could talk about how it works in terms of a picture, and there may be variations, but it's some kind of physical metaphor or picture of a moral and spiritual reality. So in terms of the nature of the sacrament, it seems like we've got to choose between one of those two things. Either it's a channel for spiritual grace coming to me through that channel, through that means, through that instrument, or we're not talking about an instrument of imparting this stuff, grace, to us. We're just talking about something that creates a meaningful metaphor of some spiritual reality.
Okay, in one, when you say it's a...
Roman numeral one now?
Uh-huh. One, the channel of invisible spiritual grace. You may not believe that it's actually the channel of grace itself, but the act of obedience could bring about certain works of God in a person's life as far as changing the person and making changes and so on and so forth. Is that what you also mean by that?
Now, one more time, say that again.
Okay. This is kind of hard to explain because I know that there are people who believe, for instance, that the Catholics, when they take the sacrament as far as so on and so forth, they feel that they're actually getting the body of Jesus
right.
And so on, and they're actually getting a certain type of spiritual food or whatever it is they believe. Okay, then I've also heard some Christians, some of the churches I've been in, that baptism, water baptism, even though it is not specifically channel of grace per se, they are saying that the act of obedience to being water baptized does open up the possibility of God working in that
right.
person's life
right.
in a certain way.
Right.
Do you mean that also?
Well, what I would say is a person who believes that is answering questions in these other columns. And if you were to press them to ask, now, but what exactly is the nature of the sacrament, I think they'd have to choose between one or two, and they could land either place. But they could believe that and believe two here, as well as one. Or they might believe one. And you just have to kind of press them and find out how are they conceiving of this, how are they picturing this. So I think one of the differences between Calvinism, for example, and Roman Catholicism is that Roman Catholicism answers one, and although Calvinism is a little bit difficult to grasp, I think they're trying to answer two. I think they're trying to say two, even though they're still going to talk about the Lord's Supper. Did I tell you I was talking about the Lord's Supper? I probably didn't. On the issue of the Lord's Supper, on the nature of the Lord's Supper, Roman Catholicism would answer Roman numeral 1, that you're actually eating the body and blood of Jesus in substantial form, and that is grace to you. Calvinists rejected that. What they do say is that present in the host is the spiritual presence of Christ. Okay, the problem is, well, what does that mean? And I think they might mean one by that, that's possible, that they mean that there really is grace there and this host really is a channel of that grace to you. But at least some Calvinists, I think, would argue, no, of course not. I mean, that's superstitious. We don't believe that. We believe that it's just a tangible physical metaphor of a moral spiritual reality. But it's a very significant thing for you to do. Once we get into the logic of the obligation to keep it, we'll see that they'll answer it in a way where whether or not you do it depends upon whether you get grace or not. But they're answering the question in the third column, then they're not giving an answer to the in the second column. They could very well answer two in that first column and still be arguing that your act of obedience in this matter is gaining grace for you, is acquiring grace for you. Okay. You see what I'm saying?
I'll pick it up.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, do you have a question that you... Anyone else on this first column? Okay. Second column, we're talking about the nature of one's obligation to perform the rite, the sacrament. What exactly is the nature of our obligation? One answer is, it is a metaphysical prerequisite to receiving grace. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is, it's just the nature of the universe and the nature of human beings and the nature of God and the way that he relates to the universe. It's just in the nature of the way things are that he can't get grace to us any other way. Or, if he could, he didn't invent that world. I mean, the world that he made and the mechanism that he chose to use involves him getting grace to us this way, and he has chosen not to, or has restricted himself in such that grace can come to us no other way other than through this sacrament, through this physical rite. So it's metaphysically somehow required that we do it, that we go to the sacrament to get grace. Second possibility: it is by virtue of a covenant that God has established, a covenantal condition for receiving grace. Okay, God said to Abraham, "Abraham, I want you to be circumcised, and I want you to circumcise every male member of your household. And 8 days after they're born, I want them circumcised. If anyone is not circumcised, they will be cut off from Israel." And what that means is, I mean, they'll be cut off from whatever he said they'd be cut off from. They will be cut off from your seed. So they will not receive the blessing, they will not receive the promises. Okay, well, there's an example of a covenantal obligation. That is, he's making it clear that we must perform this rite in order to receive the grace that has been promised in the Abrahamic covenant. If we don't perform the rite, we don't get the grace. So, when we get to the New Covenant, the Gospel, some would argue, and one position that we can take is, we have a comparable kind of covenantal obligation under the New Covenant. If we want the grace of justification, we must be baptized. We're not baptized, there is no grace of justification. We're baptized, then there is, because we've met our covenantal obligation, and that's what has to be in order for us to, under this covenant, to get the blessing. The Lord's Supper, another covenantal obligation. We must do that in order to receive the grace. So far, so good? Third option. Neither of those things are true, but it is an arbitrary, don't put too much weight on arbitrary, maybe from our perspective, arbitrary for perhaps. It is an arbitrary divine command. It is not a condition for receiving grace. Now, this notice I haven't asterisked it because I'm going to say this isn't really sacramentalism. I will ultimately reject it. I don't think it's right, but it's not sacramentalism. They have stepped out of the view of sacramentalism by saying that you don't receive, it's not a condition for receiving grace. In making that claim, they're saying something different. Logan?
So an example of those would be things like certain acts of the law, the ceremonial law.
Well, what I have in mind is like the Baptist view of baptism. The Baptist doctrine of baptism is we're going to name out our church after it, but you don't have to do it.
But if you don't do it, it's a sign of rebellion, is what I've always been told.
Well, or what I heard is disobedience. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're being disobedient, and that's why I say it is a command. So we have to do it, and if you don't do it, you're being disobedient. Is it a sacrament? Is grace tied to it? No, absolutely not. But you better do it, or you're being disobedient.
What are the implications of that disobedience? Some people I've talked to said, well, you obviously have your heart hardened against God, and you don't want what God wants, therefore you're not saved. I mean, they just go way out there with
yeah.
real quick.
Well, that's the problem, is that this doctrine is like, is a lot like tightrope walking. I mean, one way or the other, you're going to have to either fall off into sacramentalism or not. you can't really stay there, it seems to me. It's either significant disobedience or it's not significant disobedience. If it's significant disobedience, such that you're going to go to hell if you're disobedient in that way, well, then you're a sacramentalist. If actually it's disobedience but it's not a big deal, well, then you're not a sacramentalist. So I don't really know how you can stay there.
I think the word command is hard to understand in what you're saying about this one. It's a command to do it, you're saying, but grace isn't tied with it. There's something else that's tied with it, but not grace.
Well, I guess that's what I'm saying. I guess that's why I'm saying it's a hard place, it's a hard doctrine to land on and stay there, because once you start asking questions of clarification, you end up either clarifying in the direction of grace is linked to it after all, or... well, actually, I guess he commanded it, but he didn't really mean it. I mean, it seems like you have to go one way or the other. You can't
you
really
say
stay
grace,
there.
Are you talking about salvation?
Well, that's the fourth column there. Okay. Any of these, no, that's okay. I mean, any of these actually, by different people at different times, could be applied either to justification and therefore salvation. And mostly that's where people are going to link it. Or, at times, they will link it to our sanctification. Our justification may not be contingent on these things, but our sanctification is. And so I have heard people argue, no, it's neither justification nor sanctification, but there's other blessings, other grace that is going to be imparted if and only if you keep the sacraments. So, for my purposes, it doesn't really make any difference which of those three you link it to. They're all equally problematic, as far as I'm concerned.
One of the things I was talking about water baptism, one of the teachings that I've heard is that through your obedience, they don't teach that as a challenge, some might, but through your obedience, it opens up the possibility of like spiritual gifts that become
Yeah.
You're water baptized, because I've seen, and I've sat there and watched these things happen. People come up and they start speaking in tongues and stuff like that.
Which they couldn't do before the baptism?
They apparently couldn't do in most cases.
Okay.
So
that's an example of C in this fourth column. They're not linking it to forgiveness and salvation and justification. They may not be linking it to sanctification, but there are these other things, gifts, power, that kind of thing that is on the line. Is that the idea?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Fourth one in that column, easy enough to understand, there exists no obligation to perform the sacramental rite. Or to put it another way, there just are no sacraments, would be another view. I mean, another way of stating that view. Okay, on the second column. Third column, the logic of the sacramental obligation. Okay, now this may get a little complicated, but... The first option is that the sacramental rite is what I'm going to call a strict cause of the grace received. Now, what do I mean by a strict cause? I've defined it down below at the bottom of the page. And I've defined it using formal logic. Let me interpret my formal logic to you. By a strict cause, I mean one receives the grace from God under consideration. Notice I have my G, S, and H symbols defined at the very bottom. One receives the grace from God under consideration, that is, whether it's justification or sanctification or something else, whatever the grace is that we're talking about. One receives that grace if and only if one performs the sacrament that we're talking about, baptism, Lord's Supper, penance, marriage, ordination, extreme unction, whatever. So let's just, to keep it simple, let's talk about justification and baptism, okay? One receives the grace of justification if and only if one is baptized. That would be a case of what I'm calling strict cause. Now, what does if and only if mean? If and only if means if you are baptized, then you will get the grace of justification. If you are not baptized, you will not get the grace of justification, period. You got to be baptized to get it, and if you get it, you will get baptized, you will get justification, and you cannot not get justification. That's what I mean by a strict cause.
Some time ago you talked about Christianity or pseudo-Christianity under a definition of a folk religion.
Uh-huh.
Would this kind of fit under that what you were talking about in that case? That is, if we do this sort of thing, then necessarily God is kind of bound to...
I mean, there's a lot more I would put under folk religion, but this would fit with it. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Because I would argue this particular position is extremely superstitious.
Right, that's what I was kind of trying to come down to. So if I do this, then God is bound and doesn't have a choice.
Right.
To fall in line with the rest of it.
Now understand the implications of this view. The implications of this view is that you could be an absolutely hard-hearted rebel against God, could hate him to the end of the earth and get baptized, and lo and behold, you're justified. Mm-hmm. It's the water, man. It's the water. Okay?
Maybe this is under Phelan, but if a child is baptized, same thing.
Mm-hmm. Under this view. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Under this view, if a child was baptized, hey, they got the grace. Nothing you can do about it. I mean, it just happened. With the Roman Catholic view of the Eucharist, of the body of the host getting turned into the body of Christ, there were actually scholastic debates worrying about what if mice eat the host. Okay, so we understand what a strict cause is. Second option is the sacramental rite is a strict occasion of the grace received. Now I'm modifying a little bit. It's not a strict cause, but it's a strict occasion. What do I mean by that? I mean, just in simpler language, what I mean by that is, it's not as if the water causes me to be forgiven or justified, but the water may very well be something that God is insisting on in that he's going to use as the occasion for imparting to me justifying grace, and that he has tied himself to that occasion. He won't do it outside the context of that occasion.
So that would be like B or C in the second column.
Yes. I mean, there would certainly be a correlation there. Yeah. Okay, so in terms of the logic of it, if a person receives the grace of justification, or a person receives the grace of justification if and only if one performs the sacrament of, in this case, baptism, and one's heart is right in God's eyes. Because God is not obligated to impart grace on that occasion. He's only going to impart grace on that occasion when it's a case of wanting to impart grace to them. But he's not going to impart grace to anybody outside of that occasion. But those people whose heart is right, upon baptism, he will impart grace to them. If their heart is right and they never get around to baptism, tough luck. God will not impart grace to them. That's what I mean by a strict occasion, that he's strictly going to hold himself to this occasion as being the time when he will impart grace to them. Okay? Third option, the sacramental rite is a typical occasion of the grace received. Okay, in plain language, what I'm talking about is, let's soften it a little bit. God is not so legalistic about, in the vernacular, about this rite, that he couldn't impart grace to someone whose heart is right on some other occasion or some other way. But typically, his standard way of doing it is imparting the grace to them upon their obedience to the sacrament. So they're baptized, he imparts grace to them. Probably you're not going to get grace without being baptized. But in unusual circumstances, in rare situations, you're in the middle of a desert and it's just not that deep.
You're hanging on a cross and you don't have much time.
Yeah, exactly. And no one will let you down. In unusual circumstances, God will take that into account and may, in fact, on that occasion impart grace to you, even though it's not the typical occasion upon which he's going to do it. Now, most people who are sacramentalists are gonna come down here to three. They're not going to be so strict about it that they're going to deny that God has the right to do it the way he wants to do it. So most of them are going to come down here. But that's what I'm calling the sacramental rite is a typical occasion of the grace received. Okay? And then finally, the fourth option, the sacramental rite is a practice which is not essential to the receiving of any grace, which is, again, is basically just a rejection of sacramentalism altogether. All right, I think that covers the chart. So before I press on with my critique, any lack of clarity that I... Those are our options. Yeah.
With, like, in your third column, you talk about sacramental rites, the strict cause of the grace received.
Mm-hmm.
But you have all these... How do all the different sacraments relate to each other? I mean, do you have... Let's say you're talking about justification. Would, in some cases, you have to keep all the sacraments? You have to do everything? Or are there some sacraments that I mean, how does that work together?
I don't know what the Roman Catholics believe beyond baptism in the Eucharist. Beyond that, marriage, confirmation, exactly what grace they're talking about. Does anyone know? I mean, surely they're not saying you can't be justified unless you're married.
Well, that's what the marriage is the one that sticks out to me as being the one that's the most problematic. I mean, the others are particular events in a person's life. But
marriage seems different than those.
Yeah, it occurred to me in making this list, I wonder, even though the Roman Catholic Church has this list of seven sacraments that they call sacraments, I wonder if by my definition of sacraments, some of these would not be sacraments, even to the Roman Catholic. I wonder. I just don't know. Extreme unction is what happens on the deathbed. Last rites. Yeah.
My wife is a former Catholic.
And they're in their last rites.
She was raised up in a Catholic school and all works, but you probably know, but it seems to me, like I've said before, that the Catholic, ultimately they say the Catholic Church is the Church, and they have to administer the Last Supper, they have to, all the way down the line. And I know that when my wife and I were going to get married, there was a big, I mean, I wasn't Catholic, but she didn't care. You know, she was converted, quote unquote, over away from that. But her mom was really upset by it. And we checked in with some priests, and two of the priests said, "Hey, you're doing fine. Just do what you feel God's telling you to do." But her mom didn't accept that, and they told us that we could not have a priest and a pastor marry us because I would have to go through a whole bunch of background check and a whole bunch of stuff, which could take up to a year or two or three to go through. So that's quite a bit of legalistic red tape, and that's a lot of authority. So they look at marriage right on down the line as being very important as far as children and so on and so forth.
You don't know what threat hangs over your head if you are not properly have marriage administered, do you? I mean, what's the...
I don't... It seems to me I had heard my wife has told me something about that, but I'm not too sure. I can't remember.
Well, you could be in sin.
Yeah. Well, I think Catholics are encouraged to observe each of these sacraments as they can, but obviously if someone becomes a priest, they're ineligible for the marriage sacrament and the other way around.
Yeah. But, you know, this is just for normal people besides priests.
There is...
Well, but see, the problem is it raises the question, what exactly, what grace is this linked to then, or is it? I mean, maybe these aren't sacraments by definition in the sense of being linked to grace, and that's my question. I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know. I think I'd have to ask my wife, but I think it is considered sacrament marriages.
It is.
Well, no, I know it. I understand that they call it a sacrament.
What do you get out of it?
You get grace.
Do you?
What
okay.
kind of grace? I don't
yeah.
know.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Well, I always thought it was, and this is just an outsider, but I always thought it was that somehow loyalty to the church itself is a prerequisite to justification.
To justification, that's
and
true.
And so marrying within the church would be a sign of loyalty to the church itself.
That's true.
Well, you get sanctifying grace. They have justifying grace and sanctifying grace, and through the sacrament of matrimony, you are imparted a sanctifying grace.
Okay.
That is
makes it legitimate.
Empowers you in your relationship in the church. And so, if you're a Catholic, or you marry a Catholic, and you don't have the sacrament performed by a priest in a Catholic church, and as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, you're living in sin.
Right.
And in all that consequently implies. And the Eucharist gets really deep because it's extremely important in classical Catholicism for the transubstantiation to be recognized as truly the literal body and blood. Because every time the Mass is celebrated, it is a reenactment of the crucifixion all over again. And there's all kinds of grace, justifying grace and sanctifying grace that's imparted through that.
It's sort of a justification booster shot, essentially.
You have to do it every year, a minimum, one time a year. You have to have the sacrament of penance and the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist, or you're in mortal sin.
So don't move too far away from your next priest.
Yep.
Right.
Because you're more than years turned away.
Well, you name these seven because in the Catholic Church, which would be probably our kind of ultimate example, they use those seven. But I was thinking, according to your definition, there are sacramental type things that a lot of evangelicals will have in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I don't have my quiet time,
They're not officially called sacraments, but the way they think about them is as a sacramentalist would think about a sacrament. Exactly, yeah.
Well, it's just like, us dedicating our children. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to do so, but that's our answer to the confirmation.
To confirmation, yeah.
In this column, the logic of the sacramental obligation, all of these relate to the gaining of grace, as grace is a benefit.
Yeah.
But in your first column, nature of sacraments, only the first one involves grace.
Right.
The second one doesn't involve grace. Are there logics of the sacramental obligation, which fits your second nature of the sacrament?
No, because, what I'm trying to do in this column is give the logic of an obligation to a sacrament, perceived as a sacrament or thought of as a sacrament. There would be ways of talking about if the sacrament is a physical rite, if something like baptism is a physical rite, is a tangible physical metaphor of a moral spiritual reality, there may be different logics for explaining why I should enact that symbol. But I haven't concerned myself with those different things here, because if we once have rejected sacramentalism, then it's outside my topic to worry about what's the right way to think about why I should be obedient here, or what's the right way to think about why I should enact this physical symbol or physical metaphor. Well, I mean, my point is, what I'm trying to argue here is that I think sacramentalism is an alien imposition on the Christian faith. Now, you and I might disagree on exactly why we probably ought to be baptized, but if neither of us are sacramentalists, we're probably going to be basically in the same ballpark. And we're both going to be very, very different in our answers from the sacramentalist. I'm just concerned that we separate out sacramentalism as this kind of alien way of looking at things from the alternative to sacramentalism. Is that, see what I'm saying? The second one can be linked to grace, though, Dad. The physical rite is a tangible physical metaphor of a moral spiritual reality. For example, I heard a talk by R.C. Sproul on the sacraments when I went to the conference in October. And I think, if I'm understanding him, that he would have answered the nature of the sacrament as two here. But when you got to the logic of the sacramental obligation, he was talking three. I mean, he's clearly a sacramentalist, but he doesn't have a view of the sacrament as being some kind of means of grace in the sense of a channel, a tube that you stuff grace through. So he's quite willing to acknowledge that baptism is just a picture, but it's a picture by covenantal obligation. He would take B in the second column. It's a picture that, because of a covenantal obligation that we have, is the typical occasion of God granting his grace to us. Now, I don't know if he would recognize himself in three in that language in three, that I don't know, but that's roughly, I think, where he would come out. So you see what I'm saying? Even though two doesn't have to link the sacrament to grace, depending upon how you answer the rest of the columns, you could bring a link between doing that and grace back into the picture.
And they might look at some of these seven, and you might go with big A, and another one you might go with big B. I mean,
yes,
different
yes.
people might look at some.
And typically it's going to vary by what tradition you are, Calvinist, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, or whatever. But even within this tradition, sometimes you'll get some variations.
I look at big C here and D, and I kind of look at myself as kind of a combination of the two. Now, I don't know, is that possible? I mean, am I, is that, are you saying that?
Well, I think basically what you're saying is that you're on the tightrope of C falling off into D.
Yeah.
I can accept that. Because as I was saying earlier, I think it's really, you really do need to either fall up to B or fall down to D from C. It's really, I don't know how you can really stay there. Because just because there exists no obligation to perform the sacramental rite, and I think this is what you're saying, just because there exists no obligation to perform it doesn't mean it can't, doesn't rule it out as a good idea.
Yeah, because
there may be some real benefit, some real value in the ritual.
So. In the area of water baptism, or in the areas of a marriage, for instance, or whatever it is, just out of, because of God's grace and work in our lives, our desire more and more to be obedient to God is going to want us to follow his ways more and more. And of course, that's going to be viewed in some cases maybe as being sacramental.
Right, exactly.
So,
Did you have a...
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how does the sacramentalist
define grace, the word grace, because it seems to be I'm having this emperor's in clothes experience, because how can any requirements be put on grace?
And you're stealing my thunder.
Oh. Well, go on.
Go ahead, go ahead.
No, well, I mean, if it's a gift, then what kind of requirements?
Yeah. I mean, that's going to be one of the bottom-line problems that I have with sacramentalism. When all is said and done, that's why I say I think it's an alien imposition onto the gospel. It doesn't fit with the gospel. Somebody imported it from outside and just kind of stuck it on top of the gospel. Because if we rightly understand the logic of grace and the logic of the salvation that the gospel proclaims, any form of sacramentalism is a highly unlikely, it's highly unlikely that there's a mismatch. They don't correlate with each other. They don't work together. There's a tension there. They contradict each other. I want to talk about that more, but that's what you're getting at, and I think that's exactly right.
In the process, I have a question for you. Where does this come from? Does it come from a combination of the paganistic Roman ideas that were thrown in, and also from an Old Testament point of view,
yes,
which obviously some of the sacraments and some of the rituals done back then were a typology and a prophecy pointing to Jesus, but they've been carried forward into our 20th.
I think it's a combination of those two, and let me spell that out. In giving my critique, I think I will give a long answer to that question.
The word grace has a lot of theological baggage with it.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be improper to use the word benefit and get rid of the theological baggage?
That would be okay as long as you... Well... the trouble is, I think it would confuse things because I don't want to deny that there may be some benefit from the Lord's Supper and baptism, and marriage is kind of nice. And I don't want to deny that there's a benefit, but it's not going to get me justified. It's not going to get me sanctified, and it's not going to get me some other promise that God has promised and uniquely linked to this act. Is what I'm saying. So that's why I use grace to try to link this benefit to the promises of God. But other than that, with that qualification, yeah, I don't have any problem using benefit.
But if you use the word benefit there, you wouldn't be really talking about what you have in mind when you say sacramentalism.
Right, not if you use benefit and use it in a broad sense, then you're not talking about what I call sacramentalism. Yeah, Casey.
Well, I was just wondering if you could give a quick definition of justification and sanctification, and maybe some examples of what you mean by these other.
Okay. Justification is simply the forgiveness of our sins that allows us to be qualified for an eternal inheritance in the kingdom of God. So forgiveness and the inheritance that comes from that. Sanctification, within different sacramentalist viewpoint, it can either mean what I would mean by sanctification, which is something that works a transformation of my heart so that I become a more distinctive kind of person. The idea would be, for example, that something like the Lord's Supper, by partaking of the Lord's Supper, I actually find it easier to love my brother, to forgive my brother, to love my neighbor, to love righteousness, than I did before I ate that thing.
Isn't that what we typically call regeneration?
Yeah, regeneration, yeah. Some people would describe sanctification as actually my moral transformation. But they'd still argue the same thing, that you're being morally transformed by being baptized, by partaking of the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist. That's why what Jean is saying is exactly right. A lot of, in our evangelical culture, we say the same things not about the traditional sacraments, but about other little sacraments that we have developed. daily Bible reading, regular church attendance,
scripture memorization.
Tithing, yeah, especially tithing.
That's where the Catholics went wrong. They should have made that one of the seven.
Yeah. The Mormons did.
They had armies to handle that one.
Finding yourself a minister.
Pardon me?
Finding yourself a minister.
Huh. Finding yourself a minister?
Ministry.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the idea is that if you read the Bible, I mean, I might have told you this before, but I remember once I was a pastor in California. I was getting ready for a seminar that I was going to teach, and in the room next to me was a men's Bible study going on an early Saturday morning. And these men were talking, and something caught my attention as I walked past the door where I could hear what they were saying. So I stopped and listened, and this one man was saying, I read my Bible every day, and I just want to encourage all of you to do that as well. And I think what you guys need to understand that you don't understand is you should be reading your Bible every day even if you don't understand it. It doesn't really matter that you don't understand what you're reading. That's no reason not to do it, because reading the Bible is like pouring water through a charcoal sieve. Just in the process of reading the Bible, you are pouring yourself through this filter that's filtering out all of the impurities. And I said inside of me, you've got to be kidding me. You don't have to understand the Bible to get benefit out of it? What on earth are you talking about? But he was absolutely dead serious. Well, that's clearly a sacramentalist view, because he's seeing the Bible as not any sort of information coming at him. He's seeing the Bible as an occasion of God's grace, God's divine impurity filter. And you just somehow jump through it, pour yourself through it, and lo and behold, you're a better person because of it. And never mind that you didn't understand it.
You want to hear another good one?
Sure.
Years ago, I had someone tell me, he says, I found that you've got to be reading different parts in the Bible every day, because it's just like getting different parts of your diet, the vegetables, the fruit, the meat, and the milk.
I'm serious. Okay. We're in trouble.
So people that believe that you're becoming morally better by doing these things, are they assuming then that that we can achieve perfection, moral perfection on this earth, or do they not?
Usually, yeah. Not necessarily, but I mean, they may just believe that you're just making progress toward that and you'll never reach it, but many of them believe that you could, in principle.
If you did it enough?
Yeah. They would probably argue there's more to it than just reading the Bible. I mean, it's not... And then, like, you have to actually choose to obey, and they would give a role for that, a place for that. But this is more, the key is me choosing the right, making the right choices, however they define the right choices. The key is making the right choices. But the problem I have is that I'm weak. I don't have the ability to make the right choices. That's where the sacraments come in. They give me the grace, the power, the energy to next time make the right choice rather than the wrong choice. And they somehow are instrumental in God giving me the grace to do that. And then you ask about the third one. The only example that I remember talking to a real hardcore Calvinist once about infant baptism, and we were arguing about infant baptism, and I said, well, are you saying that by baptizing your children, they're automatically saved? No, I'm not saying that. Are you saying that by baptizing your children, I guess I just asked him the first one. I can't remember.
They cannot fail to become saved in the future.
Yeah, thank you. That they cannot fail to become saved in the future? No, I'm not saying that. Well, then what are you saying? And he really had a hard time articulating it, but it came down to, well, basically, as I interpret it, is, well, life's going to go better.
I've heard it.
prayer is put more strongly than that in terms of the promise that God makes. And yet, if you push a person, they kind of back away from that because it doesn't make sense.
Sound right.
Yeah. It's a weird, weird subject.
Yeah, that's the... Well, I'll explain that. But they, I mean, just like the Baptist view of baptism and the Calvinist view of infant baptism, you know, their theory says, their sacramentalist theory says, take a hard stand, and then you start asking questions about it, and they'll back off because they know better than that. They know that that's not right, and they back off into a place where it's really confused and you really don't know what they're saying, and they don't either, I think. I really, because what their sacramentalism demands that they say is that forgiveness is to be found here, justification is to be found here, but they know that's not right, so they have to back off from that, I think, in my view.
I'd like to ask you this question. The sacraments that you have listed, baptism, Eucharist, marriage, etc. I'm going to use marriage as an example. Marriage is, we're saying marriage is not a bad thing. Isn't it part of sacramentalism, in order for marriage to be part of it as a sacrament, it has to be done in a certain way?
Right. That's what Kevin was saying, that the sacrament is not just being married itself, but it's actually being married in the church by an ordained priest in the right kind of way.
So in order for
the ceremony has to be pretty long.
Yeah. Well, in order for, like, we were talking about prayer and baptism, Bible reading and that kind of stuff, to really be listed as a sacrament, you would have to tell people that there's only really only one way to pray, or there's only really one way to study the Bible.
Well, you wouldn't have to. I mean, you could. But in terms of the way I'm defining sacramentalism as just linking it to grace, that wouldn't have to be in order for it to be a belief that's coming out of that sacramentalist mentality, that set of sacramentalist assumptions.
Okay.
Now, you could. I mean, you could say you have to study the Bible in this particular way in order to get grace. But if you're Protestant enough, you're going to be allergic to that. So
we have what we call the disciplines. Is
that? Yeah. Yeah. The so-called religious or spiritual disciplines. If you read something like Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline, read the foreword to his book, he's a sacramentalist. Sure looks to me like he's saying there's grace to be had by doing this. And if you don't do it, that grace is not to be had at some level. Okay? Let's look at the critique in the little bit of time that we have left. Let me look at, first of all, at position A. It is a metaphysical prerequisite to receiving grace, that whatever this is, baptism or the Eucharist or whatever, it's metaphysically prerequisite to receiving grace. I'm going to talk about this because this is what I mean by I think this is an alien imposition on the gospel. This would follow naturally and logically from something like polytheism, if we were polytheists. If we believed that there were two different dimensions of reality, the physical world and the spiritual dimension, and the spiritual dimension was full of different forces that impinged upon my life, and if I believed that what I did in this life, in this realm, could affect and could control what happened in that other realm, in that spiritual dimension, and vice versa, and that there were certain points of contact between the spiritual realm and this realm, so that if I carry around a little amulet of my God, things are going to go better for me, and that God is going to bless me in a way that God will not bless me if I'm not carrying that amulet around. Why? Because that amulet is a certain point of contact between that spiritual realm and this physical realm. And by proximity or whatever, there's a benefit to be had from that. In that kind of worldview, the whole idea of some kind of physical act or some kind of physical substance actually being a channel of grace or blessing makes a lot of sense. But I would argue that once we have left polytheism, once we have decided that we are theists, in the sense that the Bible teaches theism, that God is a transcendent creator God who's not just the other side of the cosmos, is not just the invisible side of the cosmos. He's outside of, beyond, and above the whole thing, and is super-real, above reality, more real than real. Once we have that concept of God, then it doesn't make any sense to think in terms of God needing means to impart grace. Right? Because if he, by virtue of who he is, has access to the insides of everything in reality, then he doesn't have to use bread or water or anything in this world to be the medium whereby he can get his grace to us. Just doesn't make any sense. If God wills to effect a change in me, he does not need a means with which to effect that change. He simply calls into existence whatever he wants to exist in me. That's what he does.
But some people would see that as the reason for the creation. I mean, that would, the sacramentalists would say that he created, because God can't, you know, be with us, you know, God's distant, then the creation acts as an intermediary. Therefore, the water would be his mechanism. Okay. That would be his connection, his once removed connection to us.
But I guess my point is that that's not really a theistic view of God. If I think of God as distant and therefore needing something more proximate to me, how can God be more proximate to me than he is? He's on my insides. I mean, all he has to do is speak, and he touches me as close as anything can ever touch me.
That's a classic definition of paganism.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
That's its appeal.
Yeah, right. I think that is its appeal.
Religions are full of sacramentalism.
Right. If there is any point to his limiting himself to using a means, it is not because his grace is a substance and the means of grace is the channel through which he is elected to transmit that grace, but this view only makes sense if grace is a substance and if the sacrament is God's designated channel through which to impart the substance. That is, this view that it's a metaphysical prerequisite to receiving grace, that doesn't rule out that God may have made a covenantal obligation to always do it this way. I'm not ruling that out right now. But I am ruling out the notion that God can't get his grace to me any other way. He's got to use water, bread, or whatever, because that's like you're saying, that's close to me, and that's how he has to do it. I'm saying then, we're not talking about God then. We're talking about some big one out there, but we're not talking about the God of the Bible.
You're using physical examples under the metaphysical covering there. Is that to not consider logical necessity as well?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, we can't say that he had to use bread to get the grace to us, but there is some logical mechanism that he would have had to use by the order of the creation he set up to get the grace to us. He made reality in such a way that this logical device is necessary for grace to be imparted to us.
Now you're asking me, am I also ruling that out?
Yes.
Yes, I am. Because what I'm saying is, given the way, really, no matter how he created reality, his relationship to that reality is not going to be different in another world that he might create. If he is the transcendent creator God, then he's a God who can speak and it will be, regardless of what that world is like and what that world is. He can speak it into existence and speak it out of existence, transformation of its existence. If his grace to me is a word away, then it doesn't make any sense that he has to use means of any sort whatsoever, is what I'm saying. Which is different if God is not a transcendent God. If he's just a really, 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 really big, powerful force over there, then he's ultimately finite. And as being ultimately finite, then you could argue that, well, you know, I'm sorry, but this force just has to use water to get this done. And that sort of makes sense. I mean, it could make sense. It may not make sense, but it could make sense. What I'm saying is that view can't make sense if God is the God that the Bible says that he is.
The God that Moses met at the bush.
Right.
Is not that God.
Right. Okay, now let me jump to position... Well, let me ask you, since we're running out of time, which is the most important question that you think needs to be answered that I haven't critiqued anything yet. So I want to go to the critique that's most important to you.
No, where they find it in the Bible.
Okay.
Although I know that Catholics the Bible isn't the most important thing to them. Tradition is important. And so they don't care whether you find it in the Bible or not.
Yeah. Let me go to your question about infant baptism. Where do they find that in the Bible? So much of this stuff for, say, your Reformed theologian, your Calvinist, is strictly an argument by analogy. They go to the Old Testament and they look at the Abrahamic covenant, for example. Abraham had to be circumcised in order to receive the blessing that had been promised him, and his offspring had to be circumcised in order for them to be a member of his seed that was going to receive the blessing that was promised to them. In the Mosaic covenant, you had to keep the law of Moses and all the obligations of the law of Moses. If you didn't do them, you were going to be cut off. You had, in doing them to stay as a member of the covenant community in good standing, you had to keep the covenant. So they argue, why should it be any different in the New Testament? If in the Abrahamic covenant there was a sign of the covenant that and you had a covenantal obligation to keep in order to get the blessing, then in the new covenant of Jesus' blood, there must be some sign of that covenant that you have a covenantal obligation to keep in order to be a member in good standing of that covenant. What is it? Baptism. Why is it baptism of infants? Because it was circumcision of infants. Right? So largely by that kind of analogy, that's how they make their case, and then they will refer to a few proof texts in the New Testament that they then interpret in a way that they think substantiates that. Okay, quickly, what I would argue is there is not that analogy, that is a fallacious analogy between the New Covenant and the Abrahamic covenant or the Mosaic covenant. There is not the same kind of analogy. What would I look at to support that? Well, let's look at the Old Testament and the prophets for a second. In the Mosaic covenant, one of the obligations in the Mosaic covenant is keep the Sabbath in the Ten Commandments. Remember, there you go. Thank you. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Even the Tennessee, that's your... Okay, then the prophets come along, and they say, you want to know why you're in Babylon? What about all those Sabbaths you didn't keep? Right? So you have an explicit statement in the covenant. Look, you got to keep the Sabbath. If you don't keep the Sabbath, I'm going to... The land is going to vomit you out. The blessing is contingent upon you keeping the whole law, among keeping the Sabbath. The prophets come along and say, you guys aren't keeping the Sabbath. Boy, you're going to get it if you don't, among other things that they're not doing. And then in the end, after they have been kicked out in Babylon, they say, why are you here? Well, you're going to stay here as long as you didn't keep Sabbaths. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Sabbath is really there in the forefront all along the line. You guys didn't keep the covenant, and this was part of the covenant. Okay, let's go to the New Testament. Nowhere does the New Testament ever explicitly, with the same kind of explicitness that we are told keep the Sabbath in order to gain the blessing, nowhere is there the explicit statement, be baptized, and if you don't, your sins will not be forgiven, you will not be justified. Are there passages that could be construed that way? Yeah, maybe. So maybe that's ambiguous. In the New Testament, you have all kinds of apostolic exhortations to be holy. Not a single statement in any of those long lists of things that they want you to do in order to be holy is baptism or the Lord's Supper mentioned. Nowhere, never, ever. Is the Sabbath mentioned in the prophet's exhortation to be holy? Absolutely. I think. Absolutely, I think. If I'm wrong, correct me, but I think you would find it there. Thirdly, you have something like the letters to the churches in Revelation, where they are being critiqued in a prophetic kind of fashion, like the prophets critiqued Israel. I have this against you. Nowhere is it you're not keeping the Lord's Supper. Nowhere is it you guys just weren't baptized. You don't have any analogy. You don't have any comparable kind of emphasis on baptism and the Lord's Supper as if it were a prominent sign of this covenant, of this new covenant. It just doesn't exist. And it's very, very conspicuous for its absence, because if there is an analogy in the logic of the covenant, then you'd expect an analogy in the corresponding phenomenon. You'd expect the exhortations to be exhortations to keep the sign. You'd expect rebukes to be rebukes for not keeping the sign. But you don't find any of that. Why? I think because there is no analogy. Those are not considered to be signs of the covenant in the same way that the corresponding signs of circumcision and Sabbath keeping were signs of the other covenants. Perhaps even more importantly, if I can find my notes, okay. And this is Roger's point. Let me read my notes here. The doctrine of salvation as taught in the Bible and the corresponding teaching as to the nature of saving grace is such that it makes no sense to suggest that God's grace is contingent on a rite performed by me. That's not true in the other covenants, because the other covenants are not covenants of grace in the same way that the new covenant is. They played a different role. They played a different function. They had a different purpose. And that's why the analogy breaks down, is because they're not really fulfilling the same role in our lives, I would argue. Indeed, it almost makes a mockery out of that teaching, the teaching of grace, to suggest so. If God's grace is fundamentally a divine commitment first to sanctify me and then ultimately to glorify me, having granted me justification as a gift of his own choosing, if that's God's commitment to me, where is there any room for God to expect or require participation in a rite in order for him to follow through on his commitment? I mean, either he's made a commitment to save me or he hasn't made a commitment to save me. If he's made a commitment to save me if I do the rite, then it's not really a commitment to save me. It's sort of a hypothetical contingent thing that he might do it, or maybe even a promise that he'll do it if I do my thing. But that's not the nature of the gospel's teaching about the nature of God's commitment. His commitment to me is not hypothetical. It's not contingent. It's not an if. It's he's chosen me before the foundation of the world, and he's doing a number on me. That's what the gospel teaches, is the nature of God's grace. Well, if I'm right about that, sacraments don't make any sense. If I'm right about that, then linking God's grace to me, to being contingent upon me doing something, doesn't make any sense. His commitment to save was at his initiative to begin with, not any sort of response to me. It was at his initiative entirely. How does it make sense to suggest that it is completely at his initiative, but it's conditioned on my taking initiative to practice a certain rite? That doesn't make any sense. So I would argue that sacramentalism is an imposition on the New Testament teaching which is inherently in tension with it. It's inherently alien to the very nature of salvation and grace that the gospel teaches. And it's a very uncomfortable tension that people try to keep together, but like we were talking earlier, you know, they feel the pull of the grace of the gospel, so when you start asking them too many questions about that, they back off of their sacramentalism. But then when their analogy with the Old Testament covenants takes over, then they feel comfortable espousing their sacramentalism. But then you start pushing them on what's the nature of grace, and they have to back off again. Because it's like oil and water. They don't mix. They're not coherent with one another.
Old Testament covenants.
In large part,
they really weren't. They were to keep them, but they didn't mean, I mean, like the Mosaic Covenant, it wasn't salvation.
Right. I think that's right. It was not individual salvation, the Mosaic covenant. It was a covenant that God made with a nation, like we were talking about last fall. It's a covenant that he made with a nation in order for that nation to prosper as a nation, as a people of God. An entirely different thing. Now, somebody may rebut what I just said or come back at me and say, but Jack, faith is a condition. Faith is a condition on God's, God took initiative and decided to commit himself to save me and all that stuff, and yet he still put faith as a condition on him giving me that grace, right? So if I must take initiative and exercise faith before God will grant grace, what's fundamentally different about suggesting that from that we must take initiative and exercise the or practice the sacraments before he'll grant saving grace? Why is one okay and one isn't, Jack? Huh? Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, what is my answer?
Can't prove it.
Huh? You can't prove it, yeah. I didn't do it. You didn't see me. You can't prove it. This is an inaccurate understanding of the role of faith in salvation, though, I would argue. We do not take initiative and exercise faith, and as a consequence, having taken that initiative, God grants us salvation. Rather, the truth is, God takes initiative and justifies us and commits to sanctifying and saving us, and as a result of the process of that sanctification which he has begun in us, we respond in faith to the gospel. We believe. My belief is a symptom that God is sanctifying me. It's not a condition that I meet on my initiative in order that God will grant me grace. That's just not the way it works. And I think a lot of the reasons, especially in evangelical circles, a lot of the reason that we're comfortable with the sacramentalist mentality is because we have that view of faith. We think that faith is the currency that I use to buy God's grace with, and so if faith is that currency, maybe he'll take Bible study and prayer and meditation as well.
Why aren't the sacraments a similar symptom?
They could be if God was into them. I mean, if God wanted them, and if God had made a covenantal obligation, like some people argue, with me, that these are part of the things that you will do and that you will see in a person's life if they are being sanctified, then in principle they could be. But at that point, that's where I argue, but why would we ever conclude that they are? And that's why I say, because we're thinking like pagans, that's what leads us to think that God would see these things as manifestations of our sanctification. I mean, we start off by saying, I believe that God would I believe that they are means of grace, instruments of God's grace or something. We back off from that and say, well, no, not that, but there's still things that we have to do and we will do if we're sanctified. Well, what's left if they're no longer channels of God's grace or occasions of God's grace? If we've rejected that, what possible evidence do we have that they are signs of our sanctification? Again, none of them show up on any of those lists in the letters of the apostles saying, here's what you will do if you are a sanctified holy person. You'll get baptized and you'll eat the Lord's Supper really regularly. Just that you won't find it. I don't think. Kevin?
Stepping outside of the parameters of justification and sanctification, are there things socially, culturally, within given bodies of believers, wherein sharing communion with one another, or washing one another's feet, or baptizing, would have some benefit? Not grace, benefit.
But some benefit. Yeah, I think so.
For us, not for God, to release some grace through some channel, but some benefit, maybe psychologically or emotionally.
Yeah, I think so. It's striking when God gave Israel a commandment to keep the Passover. He said, keep this as a memorial. Well, I mean, that's interesting in itself. It's not a sacrament. It's not in order to get grace from me. I mean, I don't think anything about what he's saying even suggests anything remotely like that. He's just saying, I want you to remember I want you to remember what happened here. And the way we're going to keep that memory alive and vivid is by celebrating this, the celebration.
Like the Lord's Supper. Do this.
Okay, so the Lord's Supper could be a way of being a vivid reminder of the reality of Jesus' crucifixion and the significance of his crucifixion, and a way of keeping that memory alive.
I'm not invalidating them as
practices that we may keep, but I'm just saying there's a certain way of understanding what's going on there that I'm calling sacramentalism that's basically pagan and has nothing to do with Christianity. It's a pagan imposition on the gospel.
It's just the way it is in America that every time we find something of benefit, we make it into a formula so that everybody can... We can package it somehow so that people can...
Yeah, this fallacy is long before America. However, it's not just an American...
Pre-Columbian. Well, any of the modern sacraments, like Bible study...
Well, that's true. Like that. Exactly. Right.
Somebody found some benefits. Somebody got a rise out of it somewhere along the line. They wanted to let everybody else get in on the deal. And
right.
All of a sudden, it became a thing you have to do.
Right.
Maybe this is just wrong a statement, but you've talked about this being alien to true Christianity. It seems to me that it's more than that, that there's a fundamental evil here, in that once again we are trying to make our relationship with God doable. We're trying to construct this so that we can do it, and that just seems to be just a real obvious evidence of our evil, of our fundamental evil.
Well, I think it can be, but the reason I would hesitate to say that as a general rule is because, for example, I mentioned R.C. Sproul. I mean, I think R.C. Sproul is a great Bible teacher, a great theologian. I have every reason to think that he's a genuinely, authentically godly man. I just think he's confused on this issue. And I think his confusion rests largely because that confusion runs really, really, really deep into church history. And it's just not something that for one reason or another he's really cared to challenge. I mean, maybe he's thought about it and is thoroughly convinced, too. I mean, I'm sure he's thought about it. I'm sure he has his defense. I'm sure he would argue with me. But in the bottom line for me is, I think in part his thinking would end up being rooted in a kind of confusion. But I don't think he's evil. You see what I'm saying? I mean, I don't think his motives have anything to do with trying to avoid the truth of grace, because he understands it as well as I do, if not better. I mean, there's no question about that in my mind. But I just think he's confused in how to put all this stuff together in such a way that, just how to put all this stuff together. But there are people who are very, very attracted to something like sacramentalism, precisely because it is attractive to their rebellious sin, their evil. It's a way to put my salvation back into my hands and get God out of the picture. I think that's right. Dan, did you have a?
I was just going to say that is that we were talking to with a friend about did you choose God or did God choose you, and he was saying that he chose God, and then it went on from there, and I said, well, didn't the Holy Spirit act in you and get you to the point where you chose God? And he said, well, yeah. I said, well, then didn't God choose you first? And he says, yeah. And I said, well, why is it so important to you that you had to be the one to choose him? I mean, it's like this last little fingernail of holding on to controlling what's happening, and it seems to fit in with this sacramentalism gets you into the feeling that you're actually a co-participant in a higher role than you actually are.
Yeah, that's true. Worse than that.
I understand the feeling of that control, wanting control. But I think what it really is the absolute refusal to admit the reality that I am something God made and I exist strictly by his pleasure. I'm appointed into existence. And I don't exist for me, I exist for him. And to think that some people will say, God created me and then turned me loose. So now I have this self-sustaining immortality because it is so offensive and so frightening at the same time to think that God has just got you on a thread. You belong to Him. This isn't about you, it's about God. And the need for control, that why is it so important to you, it's frightening. It's humiliating to think that you're so small that you don't even have the right to choose not just your existence, but your future. I mean, talk about. I mean, it's worse than being a slave to most people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. A couple times early on, you mentioned that one of your objections was the sacramentalist view is that it takes the viewpoint that grace is a substance. Can you explain that?
Well, they don't. It doesn't have sacramentalists don't have to take that view, but it's not uncommon for their thinking to be assuming that. And what I mean by that is just see how different it is that what I was saying earlier, that if God wants to change you inside with the biblical view of God, all He has to do is say, change. Let there be hunger for righteousness, and there was hunger for righteousness. Let there be mourning, and there was mourning. Let there be, you know, whatever, and there was whatever. I mean, God can produce every one of the attributes of the Beatitudes in you just by speaking it into existence. Well, he's not spitting at you when He does that. I mean, there's not grace juice that's dripping into you and affecting the change. It's just His creative power by virtue of the fact that He's the Creator God. That's all He needs. He doesn't need anything else. But if you think of grace as some kind of God juice, grace juice of some kind, then how do you get it to Him? Well, let's stick it in some bread. Or let's stick it in a special tank of water and dunk people in it. Or whatever. I mean, then it makes sense. If it's a substance, then it makes sense that you have a medium to get that substance to you. But if it's not a substance, why do you need a medium?
My understanding, Jack, is that the practice in the Catholic Church of the priest putting the wafer in your mouth, mm-hmm, is because people used to take the wafer and they wouldn't eat it. They would go away and then they would use it like they planted in their garden or this is the thing that contains this grace of God, and I ought to be able to use that to accomplish something. So to keep the people from doing that, they would make him, you know, put it in his mouth and make him eat it right there.
With Duracell batteries. Stick them in your watch.
Well, you know, but however that may seem silly to me, if you're in the right frame of mind, it makes a ton of sense. But the frame of mind you have to get into is not a Christian frame of mind, it's a pagan frame of mind. And that's what we have to see, I think.
I think you have to have a little bit more of the blood.
Be in the right frame of mind.
Oh, yeah.
A little more of the beans.
I see.
You're really good at the frame of mind.
Any one final question before? Oh, yeah.
What's the difference between sacramentalism and legalism?
The trouble with that question is legalism means different things to different people. What legalism should mean, if we're going to use the term legalism in a way that gets at a mistake that the Bible is warning us against, then what legalism means is, then what legalism is the kind of self-delusion that thinks that I have the wherewithal to actually be worthy in God's eyes as demonstrated by my obedience to His legal commandments. That through my obedience to His legal commandments, I could prove myself worthy of God. That's legalism as the Bible would legitimately warn against it. That's really a moral issue. I mean, it's an issue of my delusion about my own moral state and my own moral nature. Sacramentalism is is talking about the role of these physical rites and religious ceremonies in their relationship to God's grace.
But isn't Leland just saying if you do these certain things, perform these, or, you know, follow these certain rules, then you'll be all right in God's eyes?
Yeah, okay, I see. Aren't they saying, doesn't legalism say, if you follow these rules, you will get justifying grace, and therefore is that like sacramentalism?
Isn't it overlap kind of to some degree?
Yeah, I suppose.
If you think of baptism, say,
as a command,
yeah.
It would be a moral problem if you didn't obey it, if you thought it was a misformula.
Yeah.
Because the Catholics would say, okay, you either follow on or you take the body and so on. Our way, if you don't, then that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you can't be a part of the church. That's a very legalistic point of view, really.
Yeah. Well, in conceptually, here's the difference. I think in people's minds, they could probably get fuzzed up and overlap and mixed together. But conceptually, they would be different in this way. If I think that I'm going to get justifying faith by being baptized as a sacramentalist, it's not because my getting baptized makes me worthy of it. It's because God has somehow linked the grace to that and made a promise and a commitment to correlate grace with that action. Whereas if I think that I'm going to get justification by loving my neighbor and being a good person, a legalistic mentality is I'm actually making myself worthy of that grace by showing myself worthy. And that conceptually, that's the difference, I think. Robbie?
Probably this is a big question, so you can answer. When you were talking about A and about it being a medical school prerequisite to receiving grace, that God didn't need that.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately what I thought of was Jesus. Is Jesus a means to grace? And Ron said, you don't believe so. So, no. Why and how that fits in, and is, was his death necessary? I mean,
Well, I think what she's asking is, well, what about Jesus' death on the cross? Is that a sacrament in the sense that...
Was that as a means to... Are receiving grace necessary?
Well, she's specifically talking about your point in your very first box there.
Right.
And you're saying that if God can just speak and make it so, then there's nothing metaphysically necessary
right.
for him to accomplish something. But isn't the Christian position she's asking, doesn't it seem like the Bible's saying that it was metaphysically necessary for Jesus
yeah.
to die on the cross?
I think there are many Christians who would say yes. To that, and I would not. I don't think it was metaphysically necessary. It was necessary in the context of and given the purposes of God in history. But could God have had that history go a slightly different way and accomplish our justification on a different ground than Jesus' death on the cross? I don't see why not. But he didn't. That's the ground that he supplied. That's the ground that he provided. But did he have to do that? Is that the only way God could have done it? I don't see how we can answer, well, yeah, he had to.
The kind of reasoning that you get a lot is that some sort of sacrifice was necessary.
Well, I mean, even there...
Some kind of payment, I guess, for our debt.
Yeah, you don't want to ask that here. I've rethought my whole view of the atonement. I don't think a payment is the right way to think about. The Bible uses the word payment, ransom. So, as a manner of speaking, what Jesus did is pay. But I think the way we have come to think about that as actually paying the debt that we owe to justice is not necessitated by the New Testament teaching, I would argue. And I think that there are a better image. Notice that in the book of Hebrews, that's not how the book of Hebrews argues it. The book of Hebrews does not argue that he paid our debt. The book of Hebrews argues that he was the high priest who presented himself as a propitiatory offering. So it uses the imagery, the metaphor of the offering at the temple rather than as a debt being paid. And that's highly instructive to me. And the fact that you can use one in place of the other suggests to me that Jesus' death on the cross is not, strictly speaking, metaphysically a payment. And I actually frankly like seeing that, because it solves all kinds of philosophical problems I had with the other view.
Why would God have to?
Why would he have to have a payment? How can, the biggest, hugest problem for me was, how can someone else pay my moral debt? It just breaks all the logic of moral debt. I mean, if I owe Bob $100 and you come along and give him $100 and Bob says, count it to Jack's account, I'm paying off Jack's debt, Bob says, cool. That's fine with me, because that's an economic debt. And notice, whenever we talk about our doctrine of the atonement, the analogies people always give is in terms of economic debt. But now let's change the story. Bob does something really, really mean and nasty and immoral to me, and I won't say what it is. I mean, he does something to my dog, I think. But he does something immoral with respect to me, and he deserves to get it. And lo and behold, you're walking down the street, and I just haul off and wail on you and beat you up. And in fact, you come up to me and say, I know you're really angry, Jack, beat up on me, would you? And then forgive him. The fact that you get beat up, it is of no consequence to me with respect to my problem with Bob. You can't pay his debt morally. Can you? I mean, you see the problem? He's the one that did it. What happens to you is irrelevant to what he owes me, or what he owes to the injustice of the situation that he was the perpetrator of. So, how can Jesus pay my moral debt? Either God has a very, very, very different sense of justice than I have, or I've got the wrong theory about what's going on in the atonement. And I used to think God just must have a very, very, very different sense of justice until I realized, well, wait a minute. Hebrews doesn't talk about paying debts. I think I have the wrong theory. I think we've gone beyond what the Bible teaches and have constructed a theory of what's happening in the atonement that isn't exactly capturing what's going on there.
Can you explain propitiation then, please?
Yeah. Yes.
Propitiation doesn't mean anything more or less than doing something to satisfy the wrath of the other person. So, Bob could propitiate me, very conceivably, he could propitiate me by coming up and saying, Jack, I'm really sorry.
I'll start using apples.
yeah. Or, no, what you'll do is you'll get on your knees and you'll tell me Apple is superior to IBM. Is that right?
Really.
And he could propitiate my wrath just by being contrite, perhaps. I mean, now that may not be enough, and I'm not arguing that that is enough for God. Obviously, it's not. He provided for himself a propitiatory offering in the form of a death of Jesus. So God didn't arrange it so it was enough to just for me to come before him and be contrite, period. That was not adequate. That was not enough for God. But it wouldn't have been any less a propitiation if he decided that that would be enough.
Is there an analog to the? I mean, we use the cash and carry analog to debt, to Jesus' debt, our debt being paid. Mm-hmm. But that's the wrong analog.
I think so.
What's the analog for propitiation? I mean,
What's so helpful to me about Hebrews is that it makes an analogy. Now, it's an analogy that draws on an understanding of Old Testament history and culture and religion and stuff. But it's, he says it's like the holy, the high priest going in at the on the Day of Atonement and offering the appropriate sacrifice on the Day of Atonement. Now, do we think for a second that the death of a bull paid for the sins of the entire nation? No, they didn't think that. But they thought that having done what God had said to do in the way that he had said to do it, God would find acceptable to him as a propitiation of his wrath toward the nation for their sins. Why? Because it settled the score? Because everything was even? Because God looked at that and said, boy, I like the way that bull is dead. And that's enough for me. I mean, I think we're even Stephen now. No. I mean, I don't think they even thought that they were settling the score with God. But God had said, if you do that for me, that will appease my wrath, because I will say that's enough. That's acceptable
so
to me.
Just all under his prerogative.
Yeah.
But
Jeff, when you use terms like it's not enough to appease God's wrath, doesn't that hint at some kind of necessity? That there's something, just the way you use that term, there's something necessary to appease God's wrath.
And that necessary, and that's the sense in which I said it's necessary in the context of the purposes of God. That given whatever, something about what God wants to accomplish makes this the necessary way to do it. And I think in that sense it was necessary. But if he had wanted to accomplish something else in a different kind of way, then he could have done it a different way, I think. I mean, it's conceivable to me that God could have accomplished his purposes in such a way, or had a set of purposes such that contrition might have been enough.
But are you saying, though, that there is some part of God that no matter how he could have chosen a different way to accomplish his purposes, but there's something about God's purpose that necessitates it being accomplished some way.
Right. Yeah.
So, in that sense, it's necessary. Something is necessary.
Yeah. But see, I think in order to have an accurate theory of what happened at the atonement, we'd have to have a clear picture of what purpose God was trying to accomplish by having his son crucified. If we have a clear picture of that, then I think we'll be in a position to answer why did Jesus have to die?
Maybe I'm confusing purpose and character too. Is there something necessary because of God's character that makes it necessary?
I think it's not unrelated to his character, but let me answer it this way. I think I used to would have said, that God, in the very nature of God, in the very character of God, God had a sense of justice. And God's sense of justice was such that nothing short of my death would pay for my sins, and some death by somebody would have to pay for my sins, but it could be Jesus, it could be a substitute. And that was just fixed into the very nature of God, and therefore there had to be some death somewhere that he found an acceptable payment for the injustice of my sin in order for there to be any justification at all. At this point, I'm backing off from that, and I'm saying, well, that's not exactly explicitly taught by the scriptures. It doesn't really say that. Yeah, it's an extrapolation that we've made. Is it a legitimate extrapolation? I'm beginning to wonder and think maybe not. Now, maybe it is. And, I mean, if someone could persuade me that that's a legitimate extrapolation, then that's fine. I'm fine with that. But I don't think so.
Which part? The part about God's character or about...
About it being built into the very nature of God's character, that there had that Jesus' death and nothing short of Jesus' death was required as a payment for, or let me put it this way: the fact. Here's another problem with the other theory of the atonement. In what sense was our justification an act of mercy? My argument before whether I realized it or not, would have had to have been, it was only an act of mercy in the sense that God mercifully provided Jesus to make the payment, to pay the debt for my sinfulness. That was the locus of God's mercy, was in providing Jesus to start with. Well, 2 points. One, the locus of mercy is in providing Jesus' death to start with, and the locus of his mercy was in applying his death to me. Once he's applied that to me, it is no longer an act of mercy that he forgives my sins. It is an act of justice. He doesn't really have an option. He doesn't really have a choice. Is that what the New Testament is teaching? Maybe. I mean, it's not impossible that the New Testament language could be construed in that way, but I don't think so. I think what it's saying is he's actually granting forgiveness or justifiedness, justification to me. The granting of justification to me, I think, is what the New Testament writers are seeing as an act of mercy. That, too, is the locus of God's mercy. So, but it cannot be the locus of God's mercy under that other theory of the atonement. Because under that other theory of the atonement, it's not an act of mercy, it's an act of justice.
Jack, when you say that it's part of his character, it's not part of his character to have a sacrifice. Let's say back in the Old Testament, as well as in the New. Now, in the Old Testament, of course, it's a forerunner of Jesus, but there was granted, it was obviously a certain amount of there was forgiveness there on God's part to the nation, however that worked in. But you're saying it's not part of his character. And are you relating that to the metaphysical and so on? Is that what you mean by that, in the sense that it's part of his character relating into the metaphysical?
Yeah, is it
locking him into some sort of
a, yeah, is there something in his nature metaphysically that locks him into having to have some kind of sacrifice payment in order to?
And so what you're saying is that he's not locked in, he has chosen to do this in a certain way. It's simply his choice. He could have done it any way he wanted to, but this is the way that he has chosen to do it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm proposing this. I'm not being dogmatic about this, but he could have done it any way he wanted to within the boundaries of what's consistent with his character. I mean, not just any way he wanted to, but I think he had a lot of different choices, all of which would have been compatible with his character. Only one thing was compatible with his overall purposes, though. He wanted to accomplish something by having his son crucified on the cross and die and be the propitiation for my sins. There's something concrete that he wanted to accomplish that I think could have been accomplished in no better way. Now, the key as a theologian would be to establish what exactly is it that he wanted to accomplish by doing that. And I don't know that I have an adequate answer to that or the right answer to that.
It seems to me that basically one of the problems is that we really don't, obviously we do not understand the full character of God. You know, it's really a mystery to us. And so it's very difficult. Obviously, there's so much we don't know. I'm trying to answer these questions, you know. Mm-hmm.
Isn't the real problem that we have grown up in a culture that only preaches half the gospel for so long that we get fixated on this question? Because we talk about Jesus for the forgiveness of sins, and then we throw this big party, but then we come down and go, but wait a minute, we're still sinners. And you can't go to heaven if you're still a sinner. I mean, God's not going to have the kingdom populated by people who are forgiven. He's going to have the kingdom populated by people who are righteous. And we get, I think, half the gospel for most of our lives before we stop and are struck by the fact that, wait a minute, forgiving me doesn't make me any different than I was the moment before. But that's what God's real program is all about, is our redemption as sons, the glory that is to be revealed in us. And that's not, I think, because we don't hear that, is one of the reasons we don't understand That's it's one reason why we've gone to the financial debt metaphor, and we keep doing all these because we just think it stops there, so we extrapolate all these weird explanations, and it doesn't stop there. And I think the sacrifice of Christ has to be understood in context of he could have died and been buried and paid the price, and we'd all be paid for, and God would inherit this rabble of malcontents who were paid for. And what good would that do him? You see what I'm saying? We got to understand Jesus' sacrifice in context of that God is creating a people of perfection, of beauty, and in whatever rules he made in this universe, in that respect, Jesus' sacrifice was essentially part of the plan. Now, whether he could go pull this again somewhere else and do it a different way, you're right, we don't know. But I think that part of our problems in understanding the cross is that we don't hear the whole gospel about just exactly what God has done for us.
Okay, that makes sense to me. I'm not sure how you're relating that to how we would view the cross, though.
Well, we're seeing the cross as... why do we get hung up on this, trying to make the cross this financial transaction? Well, I think that's only important because that's all we're concerned about. If we had an understanding that there's more going on there than just someone stamping our car for whatever reason and canceling our debt, then we would be open to more understanding or different interpretations about what's really going on there.
Okay.
The fact that we even ask how that worked may show that we're asking the wrong question.
Okay.
So I'm saying?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I think so. I think I'm following you.
Are you saying that basically, like it says in scriptures, that Jesus is our righteousness, and then beyond that, we the hope in which we have in Him and what He's going to do on the cross, basically?
Yeah, I mean, you don't often hear a preacher come up and says, "Hey, how many of you people are just sick to death of who you are?" I mean, how many of you looking at me and say, "I am so disgusting, I can't live with myself another day"? How many of you, and how many of you are already Christians?
I heard Schuller say that.
Huh?
I heard Schuller say that.
Oh, really? Well, I mean, it's like, the issue isn't, well, let's go get forgiven for this so we can still be scumbags. The issue is, how do I quit being like this? Well, it's not through forgiveness. It's through redemption. But that's not the issue with everybody. It's just forgiveness, forgiveness, forgiveness. Get your ticket punched.
Yeah. Well, I think that relates to to my beginnings of an answer to my question of what was God's purpose in Jesus' death on the cross. And Romans 6 is a large part of my thinking here, because the way I think he's using it in Romans 6. One thing that's always, I've never known quite what to do with it, is two or three times in the New Testament, he talks about Christ being publicly portrayed as crucified, publicly portrayed. I go, see, under the other view, it doesn't matter if it's public. If God sees it, and the debt's paid, and God knows the debt's paid, who cares if Roger knows? I mean, you know. But that's sort of a big deal to him. I mean, if that's the right translation, which is a problem. But if that's the right translation, what is he? I mean, I my other view doesn't know what to do with that. But the way he uses the crucifixion in Romans 6 is basically a significant aspect of my faith is that I look at Christ publicly crucified and I say, I belong there. That's what he's talking about in Romans 6 by being baptized into Christ. Don't you know that if you've been baptized into Christ Jesus, you've been baptized into his death? It's not possible to identify with Jesus and not identify with his death. In what sense? By recognizing that the death that he's dying there is something that I deserved rather than him. And it gets right at the heart of my self-concept. Who am I, a scumbag or not? If I am a scumbag, and I acknowledge that, and I recognize that, then, and I truly, from the depth of my being, recognize that, then I am. That's an indication I'm a child of God.
Jesus could have been stoned.
Yeah.
As a punishment, which may have, strangely enough, clicked better, because what God is saying, I'm not just going to stone you because you're a murderer. I'm going to stone you because you want to commit murder. That's the difference between this guy knows he's a scumbag and the guy who's able to pretend he's not. You know what I'm saying? I've always thought when you said, I deserve that, no, you deserve worse.
Right.
Because eternal hell is worse than, right, you know, being in the electric chair or whatever. But if it is death for sin, then we all deserve, as the law demanded, if you're a murderer, right, you'll be stoned. Right. If you're a rapist, you'll be stoned. You'll, right, be killed. But now here's a guy getting killed. But let's face it. I mean, I'm a murderer. I'm a rapist. I deserve to be killed.
Right.
But see, I can say that. Because, right, the grace of God is maybe able to see that. Now, is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly.
Identifying with him?
Exactly.
Like, I deserve a criminal's death.
Yeah.
I deserve an execution because my heart is the heart of a criminal.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is maybe the way to understand the cross and God's purposes in the cross is that he was having his son make a statement about God's view of sin. Is it because Jesus' death on the cross adequately paid for anybody's sin? No. It didn't. I mean, that's the other thing. Is that do I deserve hanging on the cross? No, I deserve a whole lot more than that. I deserve utter eternal condemnation, and anything that God is dishing out is what I deserve.
Jesus kind of went beyond the cross and descended into.
Yeah, but there was another, but even there was another philosophical problem that I always had trouble with, and that is, if I would have had to spend eternally condemned for my sin, why did he only have to do it in 3 days?
Once you're in eternity, time doesn't matter. So.
And besides, but, he got to come back.
And he got to come back, exactly. How is that really payment for my sins? How is he paying? How is he getting exactly what I would have got had God given to me what I deserved? Well, I don't think he is. But see, that's no longer a problem under this view, because God is not pretending that he's paying for my views, paying for my sins. He's saying my son there is making a statement about what I think about your sins. What do you think about his statement about what I think about your sins? And faith responds to that by saying, I think that statement's right.
How does, when the context of what you're talking about here, you can't fit it in, but how does the purpose of Jesus, the Messiah, of the Word of God becoming flesh, the Son of God, for the purpose of him to become a high priest, to be human, to be able to experience what we experience, obviously, maybe I'm wrong in my thinking, but God did not, he was not human even though he created us. So by Jesus taking on human form, he was able to be tempted and to be understand, you know, so on and so forth. So how does that all fit into what we're talking about here? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm not sure I fully understand how it all fits in, but that's the argument of the book of Hebrews, is that he wouldn't have really been qualified to be my high priest had he not been one of us, had he not been fully a human being. Now, what's all the reasoning that goes into why you can't be a high priest without being a human being? I'm not sure that I understand all of it. But I think it's because the function of the high priest was to be a mediator who was a man representing mankind to God, as well as representing God to mankind. Well, only a human being can represent mankind to God. Yeah, he has to be from among humanity in order to represent humanity. That makes a certain amount of sense. Now, I mean, in another world, could a Martian be a high priest for humanity? Well, I don't know. But in this world, the way God purposed to do it, he sent a human being to come out from among us and be the true high priest.
Then, okay, let's say, okay, God chose to send Jesus and chose this way to redeem us. Would that show the purpose of why he chose that way? Because of, obviously, of Jesus becoming a person, becoming a human, and being able to relate to us, to become the high priest and so on and so forth. And all the system that he set up in the Old Testament fall in line with the New Testament stuff.
Well,
would that show the purpose in which you're talking about? So,
if I followed your question, I mean, at least part of what you're saying. See, some people argue, well, Jesus had to do it this way because look at what happened in the Old Testament. But I think that's backwards. The reason the Old Testament is the way the Old Testament is because God knew all along he was going to do Jesus the way he was going to do Jesus. So, you know, we mustn't look at Jesus and say, well, you know, like the Old Testament shows us, we have to have a high priest and offerings and stuff like that. Well, God wouldn't have had them have a high priest and offerings and stuff like that unless that reflected what he knew before the foundation of the world. He was going to have the true basis of justification here in Jesus. So Jesus is the true high priest of which all that in the Old Testament are just shadows and anticipations. They get their meaning from him, not him from them.
Right.
Now that was only part of what you said, but...
I was just trying to relate to the fact that you originally said that the idea that part of God's character is not part of God's character, and why, you know, he could have chose many different ways, and that's true, but he chose it because he obviously wanted to, he had preordained before the foundations of the world the idea of sending the high priest, the ultimate high priest, the Son of God into the world and to be man so he could relate to us and understand our weaknesses and our sinfulness and so on. And that's even skipping over the Old Testament. So the Old Testament is obviously is there to prophesy and to set up. And that gives the purpose of what you were talking about, why he chose that way.
Now, I just want to be clear on what I mean by not in the character of God. It's obviously related to the character of God, though, because under this theory that I'm proposing, it's in God's character to hate and to repudiate sinfulness and evil, human sin and evil. That's part of his character. And he couldn't be otherwise than a hater of evil, I think. So Jesus dying on the cross to make a statement about what God thinks about evil for us to either fall in line with or not, that's related to his character in that sense. You see what I'm saying? But what I mean by it's not so fixed in his character that he had to have Jesus die on the cross in order to do this. It's not inconceivable to me, if my theory is right, now that's a big if, but if my theory is right, it's not inconceivable to me that he could have had, you know, some, on Mount Rushmore, he could have got there before the presidents.